This morning I pick up a theme begun last week. Images that we're standing with the Israelites on the borders of Canaan, having reconnoitred the land. Humanity across the face of the planet faces one of two alternative futures. On the one hand, there's the breakdown of all organized and civilized life everywhere, perhaps even the extinction of our species, a new way that's embraced by the whole of global humanity, our global culture. There's no halfway house, no muddling through. The political and social compromises we're constantly making, even as we become aware, with ever greater force with each passing year, will at the very most extend the onset of the catastrophe by a few years, perhaps long enough for us to die off. We, who are still living off the future, content to leave it to the next generation to suffer the consequences and enter the disaster. In all this prospect of catastrophe, religion, including Christianity, stands convicted as being a prime mover in the events that are unfolding. At very least, guilty of complicity in that we have not given challenge, not the word of God, but wishful thinking, even exploiting the disaster. Two images from the 13th chapter of Ezekiel haunt me. The first is the image of the religious leaders who are like those who plaster over the cracks in the wall to create the pretense that all is well. That is wishful thinking. And today, that's where there is the growth in the Christian adherence. It's almost entirely built upon the willingness of people to believe in promises that are based on what we wish God would do. But the wall is cracked and will fall down, bringing ruin and disillusionment to those who trusted in the religious leaders and pastors. The other image in Ezekiel 13 is of jackals among the ruins, those who feed off the disaster, profit by it, and that, too, describes only too graphically the character of so much religion in our day. The entire cacophony of merchants of the so-called prosperity gospel are Ezekiel's jackals. That's how they prosper. They feed off the poor and the vulnerable and the dispossessed. Their mega churches are the shame, not the glory, of the Christian community. In last week's address, I drew on the old scriptural story of the desert wandering to picture where we, the faith community, has arrived at. We have arrived at the border of Canaan, the land to which God has guided the community. We have reconnoitred it. We know its character and the challenge it faces us. We know that to enter into the land will change us and our way of life. This is the call of God, but the faith community is choosing to refuse the call and to opt to stay in the desert, consigning the entire generation to death. That's the significance of the embrace of counterculture by the greater part of the Christian community, even more so in Islam and other religions. But there's much more at stake than even in the desert story. The choice of the Christian community to turn its back on the call of God spells doom for all humanity. For in what we have lies literally the key to humanity's salvation. We doom not just ourselves and our generation. We doom all future potential generations, not just of the faith community, but of all humanity. The stakes are that high. And the core of the problem, the church doesn't, by and large, care. Consumed by its own culture of selfish introspection and living by wishful thinking. Oh yes, I'm aware to the degree to which Christians become involved in humanitarian aid. But even that can be seen through the eyes of the story, imaged of those who make a desperate sortie into Canaan, only to be driven back. We can choose differently. We can follow the call of God. We don't have to reject where God has led us. The most fundamental part of responding to God's call lies in the acknowledgement that global culture is a creation of the Spirit of God as much as it is a product of human endeavor. It's ambiguous on both fronts. Here again, we can draw on the old Hebrew story, but now extending it beyond the desert to the era that follows the entry into the land after 40 more years of wandering. The story is embraced in Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. No matter that none of this is actual history, it's real inner history, and it's real because it displays so powerfully the ambiguity of life in the promised land. It was no land of milk and honey, of peace and prosperity. It was never possessed by the Hebrew people, who were ever only one element in a polyglot population. Whatever the myths, it was never, quote, their, unquote, land, only ever shared with others. Even in religion, the Hebrews were polytheists, worshipping many gods, and this was true right up to nearly the time of Jesus. Yet in all this messy existence, far, far from any ideal that advocates of strict Judaism may have promoted, we see the hand of God in unique power and creativity. Never, ever think that if global culture becomes mature and brings a new way of living to humanity, that it will ever match any ideal. Our promised land will be as messy, as ambiguous, as almost pathetically inadequate as anything we see when we look back on the real story of the Hebrews. It's in that fact that we rediscover the power and relevance of the scriptures for our day, including very significantly the Old Testament narrative. The scriptures witness not to a call to a perfect society, but to a recognition that the land that God calls us to enter will bring with it all the messiness of life that we know and all the ambiguities that we wished we didn't know. The most terrible and destructive movements within humanity in every age have been those driven by idealists. We so often exalt people for idealism, especially young people. We should be warning against all idealism, and most especially of all, against all and every form of religious idealism. Look back over the roll call of idealists of the last century. The Russian communists, the fascists and Nazis, the South African nationalists and their apartheid system, Pol Pot and the killing fields of Cambodia, all driven by ideals. Today, who are the idealists? Bin Laden when he was alive, ISIS, Boko Haram, multitude of Christian sects proclaiming that they have the way of God, even many a Western liberal in their PC pursuits. At the heart of all idealism lies the denial of ambiguity and the embrace of wishful thinking. If you do things my way, the promised land will be all milk and honey. All idealism ends in destruction and disillusionment and despair. And this is intensified when our idealism is put into a religious framework so that we come to believe that this is God's way. The authentic way of God throughout history, in all history, has always been the way of messiness and ambiguity. When Luke wrote his account of the Christian movement, aiming to convince the Roman authorities that Christianity was a good movement for the empire, he created an idealized picture of the first generation of Christians in the early chapters of the Acts of the Apostles. This picture served his purpose, but he created a curse that's been upon the church ever since, the curse of believing that there had been a pure time. And if we could get back to being like that time, all will be well and the church would once again grow like Luke portrayed it. Luke's account was pure indeed, pure fiction as far as we can see at this distance. The church we do see, particularly through Paul's letters, was a messy, ambiguous community fraught with tensions and discord and split into factions. Paul himself, in his towering greatness, was deeply flawed in person and theology, as much wrong as he was right. Read any document of the New Testament and we cringe as much as we celebrate. It is messy, it's ambiguous. Yet in it and through it all, through the life of that first century church and all its writings, the creative spirit of God was and is manifest. The church of the 21st century now, and however it shapes itself in the rest of our years, is and will always be messy and ambiguous. This is the way of God. The way of denial of God lies in pursuit of purity of life and theology. Manifest in breached communion, that path leads only back into the desert and death. The call of God is to go forward into the world that has been created, and that world is one of global culture. That is the way of life, even if that life is messy and ambiguous. This is the path of salvation for humanity, and it's the path that will continue to embrace the gospel and the church. If global culture does indeed mature and succeed in enabling humanity's survival, it will be accompanied by a global spirituality. If the Christian community takes the path into the desert, that global spirituality will not be characterized by Christianity. If we choose today to walk with God, Christianity will lie at the heart of the culture of the whole of surviving global humanity. So the issue can be stated as asking ourselves whether we are at all interested in the salvation of humanity, or is what we want is to be a community of the self-righteous and the self-regarding and no use to God. If we are to choose to go with God, then there are crucial strategies to be found and adopted. If we go back again to the Canaan story, had the Israelites responded to God's call and entered the land, they would have needed some clear and workable strategies to overcome the challenge of the inhabitants and the environment which would have been presented to them. To confront any task, however mundane and trivial, or great and portentous, good strategies are needed. To venture forward with God is going to require a set of key strategies that the church needs to put in place. These strategies will individually and collectively change the face of the church as we know it. Just as had the Israelites entered Canaan at God's direction, they would have changed. Not only from their life as a wandering desert people, but from their entire way of life that they had developed, according to the story, during 4 centuries in Egypt. For shorthand, then, I'll talk about the change between the Egypt church and the Canaan church. The first of these strategies, and the most fundamental, is a complete and top-to-toe change in the way we know anything, including the way we communicate and transmit knowledge. The Egypt church located its knowing in propositions stated in the distant past, or in propositions laid down by popes or Reformation fathers. We know because somebody whose ultimate authority we accede to, said something, and because they said it, it must be true. The most ultimate of these authorities, of course, was the recorded words of Jesus Christ, as written down in the Gospel. If Jesus directed that divorce was impossible, impossible it had to remain for all time and all people. If Paul condemned homosexual relationships, that's unchallengeable by any age or culture. Biblical literalists go even further and take every statement, however bizarre and far-fetched, and accord it this ultimate status simply because it is written in Scripture. There's no possible defense today that can justify the church remaining in this Egypt mode of knowing by old propositions, or new ones either. The credibility of that way of life has been undercut fatally. A Canaan church embraces the recognition all-knowing, not just scientific, but also spiritual, is the product of a process, and that process is dynamic and never-ending, except when it reaches a dead end that recognizes that the claim to know is false and delusional. This means that we're confronted with the challenge to re-examine and rethink all our theological concepts and even the most central tenets of church teaching. All of them. From the ground up, including the foundational assumptions. It means that we have to completely change the way we proclaim the gospel message and seek to transmit the faith. The consequences will be profound as we shift from being an Egypt church to being a Canaan church. The second strategy is a fundamental orientation of the faith from being future-orientated to being present-orientated, from being otherworldly-directed to being present-worldly-directed. Insofar as we can see through the ambiguity of the records we have of Jesus, the conclusion can legitimately be reached that His life and teaching were focused on the present and on this world. That's certainly true in essence of the Hebrew prophetic movement of which Jesus is the return. It would seem also that Paul's radical recasting of the Christian narrative shifted the focus from the present to the future, and from this world to an apocalyptic future. And this Pauline shift has dominated the church's thinking and practice ever since. This worked because the whole cultural climate related to this way of thinking, both in the Gentile community to whom Paul was adapting the message, and its successors' cultures, as in the West. It's probably the reason why traditional Christian message is still working in Africa and parts of Asia. Global culture is orientated wholly to both the present and to this world. It recognizes that the present is the only reality we have. The past is gone and no longer real. The future exists only in our imagination. The only place anything is real is in the present. If the gospel is to relate in any way to the new culture, it has to be about the present. It has to be about this world, not some imagined other world. The implications of this are vast for the church as it moves from Egypt to Canaan. It means the shift from a faith based on promise of a future land to living in that land. It's no longer feasible to talk about the world to come as a land flowing with milk and honey if the people living in that land know that this is simply not true, or at least not in the kind of truth embodied in wishful thinking. We can express it this way. Today we may attend the Eucharistic liturgy and receive the sacrament. In the Egypt church, this was said to be a foretaste of the heavenly banquet to come in the promised land. One day, we would feast with God face to face and know God completely. One day, we'd look around and see the entire company of the faithful throughout the ages. In contrast, living in the Canaan church, we encounter God in sacrament and life at this moment, in this place, as fully and completely as we will ever know God. The sacramental meal is the pinnacle of life and our relationship with God, and there'll be nothing beyond this. Far from being a disappointment for those whose spirituality is orientated to wish for something better and more glorious and less ambiguous, the result is a transformation of all of present life. The sacrament is a window into seeing God and grace in everything, so transforming and redeeming everything. The sacrament is the key to living life in the present, in this world. It's the central point of life in Canaan. For those who may have already read my Sunday morning meditation with its notes about the challenge to how I was shaping this address, the answer to the question is that it was at this point that the meditation spoke, for it challenged me about hope for the future. Life can't be lived without hope. And as we enter the time of trouble that lies ahead, salvation lies in having hope. The difference is this. The Egypt church located hope in a land that was utterly different to the one they inhabited. The Canaan church locates hope in the future that is located in what we know in the present. I express hope in this way. My hope, grounded in my entire experience of faith, is that the future, the immediate future or the future counted in millions of years, will be identical to the present. The outward conditions may change for better or worse, but what the sacrament reveals as the grace of God in everything, redeeming and transforming everything, will never change. This is the power of the doxology. As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Hope is knowing we shall always dwell in Canaan, for this is our promised land. The third crucial strategy as we move into taking possession of Canaan is that we shift the whole orientation of our relationship with the land. And being the Egypt church, we were aliens in the land and to its culture. Now The land is our own. The culture is our own. We are its inhabitants, though not alone in that. We are to undertake a fundamental shift in our relationship with the land and the culture. At the heart of the message that reaches us from Jesus is the concept of servanthood and stewardship. It's time to take this message to heart and realize that we, the church, are functionally related to the world of global culture as servant and steward. In the imagery of the metaphor, the entire enterprise can't exist without service and stewards. The owner of the vineyard or the owner of a modern corporate can't do without people doing the work, the service. What never works is when the servants think that they're boss, or when they are, in fact, working for another enterprise or rival company, or if their hearts are not in their work. All that describes essentially the relationship the Egypt church had with its cultural partner, whatever form that took. It was different in the Eastern Orthodox Church, but there the relationship was one of complete subservience of the church to the state authorities, and that's not a healthy model either. In Canaan, the church embraces the culture as a servant serves in the spirit of Jesus. This doesn't mean subservience, as in the Eastern Orthodox model. Nor does it mean dominance and control, as in the traditional Catholic model. It means that we recognize that the aims of the culture are our aims for our world, and seek to serve those aims. This means seeing beneath the outward forms and actions that manifest at any particular time and place, and see how everything relates to the fundamentals. This may lead us constantly into prophetic challenge to how the culture expresses itself in any given time and culture. It means that we seek to embed the core values that enable the culture to succeed into the hearts and minds of all the people, so that they act not out of fear and coercion, but from within themselves. That means that the Canaan church embodies, however fragmentarily and ambiguously, the core values of the culture. It models what it means to live successfully, and in fact can never expect any part of the world to embody those values in a way that we ourselves fail to realize. If we can't live in perfect harmony and pureness, we know that to expect this of anything else is fantasy. Every culture is always under threat. Sometimes those threats are external. Much more commonly, those threats come from within. We only have to look at the way in which the world of Islamic culture has been torn apart today from within. Or the old Egypt form of the Christian community has been torn apart from within over the last generation. There are always demonic and distorted forms arising and seeking to take control, often allied with religion, as we see demonstrated again and again in our world today. The Canaan church expresses its servanthood in acting as guardian and protector, prophetically warning of the danger and challenging the demonic forces as they manifest. It does so not in the name of another land, but in the name of the land in which it lives. These three strategies, then, in the way we know, in our orientation to reality found in the present and in this world, and the embrace of servanthood as a Canaan church, these three strategies are crucial if humanity is to follow the call of God and enter the land to which our God has led us from Egypt to its border. The question now confronting the whole community is this: do we follow God, enter the land, and embrace the strategies that will so change us? Or do we insist that we cannot change, even if this means being consigned back into the desert and death? Life or death, the choice is ours.